Welcome to SCOTUScast, Uranium Enrichment Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Monday, January 26th, the Supreme Court announced its decision in United States v. Eurodif. In this case, the court considered whether the Commerce Department is entitled to Chevron deference in its classification of uranium enrichment contracts as involving the sale of a good rather than of a service, which would subject the transactions to federal anti-dumping statutes. In a unanimous decision delivered by Justice Souter, the court held that the department's construction is reasonable and is therefore entitled to deference, reversing the Federal Circuit decision below. To discuss the decision, we bring back, from our post-argument podcast on this case, University of Minnesota Law Professor Kristen Hickman. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Hickman.
The Tariff Act of 1930, 19 U.S. Code Section 1673, imposes an extra anti-dumping duty on foreign merchandise that is sold in the United States for less than its fair value. This anti-dumping duty does not apply to cross-border provision of services. The issue in the Eurodif case was whether uranium enrichment contracts are contracts for sales of merchandise, which fall within the scope of the anti-dumping statute, or contracts for services, which do not. The contracts in question called for utilities in the United States to purchase raw uranium, turn that raw uranium over to processors in Europe who enrich the uranium and send it back to the U.S. utilities. Under the contracts, ownership of the uranium at all times rests with the U.S. utilities. Hence, the utilities claim that the processors are only providing services in enriching the raw uranium. However, as the government observed, the raw uranium goes directly from the supplier to the European processors, who both commingle the raw uranium of their various customers and also fundamentally transform its character before sending it on to the U.S. utilities. In other words, even though the U.S. utilities formally accept ownership of the raw uranium, the transactions are substantively indistinguishable from a scenario in which the European processors purchase raw uranium themselves, enrich it, and then sell the enriched uranium product to the U.S. utilities. And that scenario would clearly constitute sales of merchandise subject to the anti-dumping statutes. Both sides presented this case as one of pure statutory interpretation. How does one define a sale of merchandise for purposes of the anti-dumping statute? Or, more precisely, do the uranium enrichment contracts that issue in this case represent sales of enriched uranium, which is merchandise, or sales of uranium enrichment services, which are not merchandise, as that term is used by the Tariff Act? As mentioned, the Commerce Department decided that the uranium enrichment contracts were contracts for the sale of goods rather than services. Complicating the Commerce Department's case, it had previously adopted a regulation that seemingly would have treated the uranium enrichment contracts as service contracts, but subsequently withdrew that regulation. In an opinion written by Justice Souter, a unanimous Supreme Court held in favor of the Commerce Department's interpretation. As is so often true of administrative law cases, the more interesting implications of this case rest not in the court's holding, but rather in how the court got there, and the underlying issue that the court failed to address explicitly. Of course, whenever a reviewing court is evaluating the validity of agency legal interpretations, the line of inquiry that springs to mind is that of Chevron, Skidmore, and Meade. Justice Souter's opinion in Eurodif is no exception. In a fairly succinct application of Meade and Chevron, Justice Souter recognizes in a conclusory fashion with little analysis that the Department of Commerce has primary interpretive authority over the Tariff Act, that the Department exercised that authority in the course of adjudicating the utility's claims, and that the statute is ambiguous. Hence, we find ourselves in short order at Chevron Step 2. Here, Justice Souter points to the Supreme Court's 2005 decision in National Cable and Telecommunications Association versus Brand X Internet Services for the proposition that the Commerce Department's alleged interpretive inconsistency with the previously existing regulation is irrelevant for Chevron analysis, as the whole point of Chevron is to leave the discretion provided by the ambiguities of a statute with the implementing agency. The rest of Justice Souter's position represents a fairly straightforward application of Chevron Step 2, outlining various reasons why the Commerce Department's interpretation treating the exchange of cash and an untracked fungible commodity for a substantially transformed version of the same commodity as a transaction for the sale of merchandise is reasonable as an elevation of transactional substance over contractual form. What Justice Souter's opinion neglected to do is to provide any explanation beyond a bare reiteration of Meade's two steps as to why it is that Chevron, rather than Skidmore, provides the appropriate evaluative standard. Remember that Meade tells us that Chevron only applies where Congress gives an agency the authority to bind regulated parties with the force of law, and where the agency in turn exercises that authority. Meade also recognizes in particular that most Chevron-eligible interpretations are the result of notice and comment rulemaking and formal adjudication within the procedural requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act, and that these formats are a very good indicator of delegation meriting Chevron treatment. It does not appear from the record that the Commerce Department utilized either of these procedural formats in adopting the Tariff Act interpretation at issue in Eurodif. Rather, the Eurodif adjudication appears to be what administrative scholars would characterize as informal adjudication. This lack of procedure does not necessarily preclude the interpretation's eligibility for Chevron deference. The Meade Court was quite clear that the want of notice and comment rulemaking or formal adjudication are not dispositive. The Court cited for this proposition in particular the 1995 case of Nations Bank of North Carolina versus Variable Annuity Life Insurance Company, which involved an informal adjudication to which the Court applied Chevron deference. Yet the interpretation at issue in Meade also came through informal adjudication in the form of a tariff classification ruling letter. And the Meade Court found that informal adjudication ineligible for Chevron deference, concluding that the less deferential review standard of Skidmore versus Swift applied instead. According to the Meade Court, the informal adjudication at issue in that case was not entitled to Chevron deference for several reasons. Tariff classification ruling letters are limited in application only to the parties to whom they are issued, with respect to articles identical to the sample submitted with the ruling request. Various offices of the Customs Service issue thousands of such ruling letters each year without necessarily coordinating between offices. Most tariff classification ruling letters contain little or no legal reasoning, although the particular ruling letter at issue in Meade did contain a rationale in some detail. In sum, according to the Meade Court, it seems apparent that Congress would never have envisioned tariff classification ruling letters as carrying the force and effect of law, as the Court requires for Chevron deference to apply. To the extent the Court drew an implicit contrast with the Nations Bank case, the adjudication at issue in that case was in fact quite different from the Meade Court's description of tariff classification ruling letters. The Nations Bank case involved the Court's application of the Chevron standard to evaluate an interpretation of the National Bank Act advanced by the Comptroller of the Currency in an informal adjudication documented by a ruling letter. Since the Nations Bank case predates Meade by several years, of course the Court's opinion in Nations Bank does not offer the sort of analysis required by Meade. Nevertheless, the Nations Bank Court did recognize the Comptroller of the Currency as bearing primary administrative responsibility for the statute at issue. And given the context in which the Meade Court cited the Nations Bank case, one must assume that the Court regards the circumstances surrounding the ruling letter issued by the Comptroller of the Currency as distinguishable from a Customs Service tariff classification ruling letter. Nevertheless, a big question mark for Chevron scholars after Meade is when precisely does an informal adjudication qualify for Chevron deference under Meade's two steps? Now we have Eurodif, an informal adjudication that Justice Souter tells us, without further explanation, qualifies for Chevron deference. The lack of further explanation is perhaps not too surprising, as the regulated parties as well as the government in Eurodif claimed that the interpretation at issue satisfied Meade's requirements for Chevron rather than Skidmore review. Nevertheless, lawyers responsible for litigating agency legal interpretations advanced through informal adjudication will simply have to evaluate the ways in which the circumstances of those interpretations compare or contrast with rulings issued by the Department of Commerce under the Tariff Act, in addition to the ruling letters interpreting the National Bank Act issued by the Comptroller of the Currency and tariff classification ruling letters issued by the Customs Service. Still, given the attention that the Court has given in the past decade to issues of Chevron scope, I, for one, am disappointed both by the failure of the regulated parties in this case to raise a question about Chevron's applicability and by the Court's brief and conclusory analysis on that issue.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.